page 3, top of the page. Witness. Neil, do you want me to read the whole thing to them? The document is already in evidence. They can read it for themselves. Mr. LeJudas. Please, humor me. Witness. Quote, Jacob exhibits behavior and expresses thoughts and inclinations, both in private session and in his history outside direct clinical observation, that would support any or all of the following diagnoses in isolation or in combination. Reactive attachment disorder, narcissistic personality disorder. Look, if you're asking me to comment on a psychiatrist's clinical diagnosis, Mr. LeJudas, please, just one more. Page 4, paragraph 2, the sentence I've indicated with a sticky note. Witness. Quote, the best way to summarize this entire constellation of observations, lack of empathy, difficulties with impulse control, occasional cruelty, is to say that Jacob resembles the Grinch of Dr. Seuss. His heart is two sizes too small. Unquote. Mr. LeJudas. You look upset. I'm sorry. Does that upset you? Witness. Jesus, Neil. Jesus. Mr. LeJudas. Is this how you felt when you first heard that your son had a heart that was two sizes too small? The witness did not respond. Mr. LeJudas. Is this how it felt? Witness. Objection. Relevance. Mr. LeJudas. Noted. Now answer the question, please. Is this how it felt? Witness. Yes, how do you think I felt, for Christ's sake? I'm his father. Mr. LeJudas. Exactly. How is it that you lived with a boy who had the capacity for this sort of violence all these years, and you never even noticed it, never suspected one thing was out of place, never lifted a finger to address these psychological problems? Witness. What do you want me to say, Neil? Mr. LeJudas. That you knew. You knew, Andy. You knew. Witness. No. Mr. LeJudas. How is that possible, Andy? How could you not know? How is that even possible? Witness. I don't know. I only know it's the truth. Mr. LeJudas. Again with that. You sure do stick to your talking points, don't you? You keep saying the truth, the truth, the truth, as if saying it makes it so. Witness. You don't have kids, Neil. I don't expect you to understand. Mr. LeJudas. Enlighten me. Enlighten all of us. Witness. You can't see your own kids straight. No one can. You love them too much. You're too close. If you had a son, if you had a son. Mr. LeJudas. Do you need a minute to gather yourself? Witness. No. Have you ever heard of confirmation bias? Confirmation bias is the tendency to see things in your environment that confirm your preconceived ideas and not see things that conflict with what you already believe. I think maybe something like that happens with kids. You see what you want to see. Mr. LeJudas. And what you don't want to see, you choose not to? Witness. Not choose. You just don't see it. Mr. LeJudas. But in order for that to be true, for it to be confirmation bias, you would have to genuinely believe in the thing, because you're talking about an unconscious process. So you would have to genuinely believe in your heart of hearts that Jacob was an ordinary kid, that his heart was not two sizes too small, correct? Witness. Yes. Mr. LeJudas. But in this case, that couldn't be true, could it? Because you had reason to be on the lookout for signs of trouble, didn't you? Your whole life, Andy, you've been aware of the possibility, isn't that true? Witness. No, it is not. Mr. LeJudas. No? Did you forget who your father was? Witness. Yes. For 30 years or so, I forgot. I meant to forget. I purposely forgot. I was entitled to forget. Mr. LeJudas. You were entitled? Witness. Yes, it was a personal matter. Mr. LeJudas. Was it, though? You never really believed that. You forgot who your father was? Forgot what your son might become if he turned out like Grandpa? Come on. You don't forget a thing like that. You knew. Confirmation bias. Witness. Step back, Neil. Mr. LeJudas. You knew. Witness. Step back. Get out of my face. Act like a lawyer for once. Mr. LeJudas. Well, now, there's the Andy Barber we all know. back in control of yourself, master of self-control, master of self-delusion, master actor. Let me ask you something. Those 30 years when you forgot who you are, where you came from, you were telling yourself a story, weren't you? For that matter, you were telling everyone a story. In a word, you were lying. Witness, I never said anything that was not true. Mr. LeJudas, no, but you left a few things out, didn't you? You left a few things out. The witness did not respond. Mr. LeJudas, and yet now you want the grand jury to believe every word you say. Witness, yes. Mr. LeJudas, all right then. Go on with your story. Chapter 23. Him. Northern Correctional Institution, Summers, Connecticut. The visiting booth at Northern seemed designed to disorient and isolate. A claustrophobic sealed white box, about 5 feet wide by 8 feet deep, with a window door behind me and a plate glass window in front. A beige dial-less phone on the wall at my right hand. A white counter to rest my arms on. The booth was designed to keep the prisoners caged in, of course. Northern was a level 5 maximum security facility that permitted only no-contact visits. But it was I who felt entombed. And when he appeared in the window, my father, Bloody Billy Barber, hands cuffed at his waist, a tangle of ash-gray hair, smirking down at me, amused, I suppose, at his pissant kid showing up here finally. I was glad for the thick glass slab between us, glad that he could see but not reach me. The leopard in the zoo wanders to the edge of his pen, and through the bars or across an unjumpable moat, he stares at you with contempt for your inferiority, for needing that barrier between you. There is a shared understanding in that moment, nonverbal but no less real. The leopard is predator and you are prey. And it is only the barrier that permits us humans to feel superior and secure. That feeling, standing at the leopard's cage, is edged with shame at the animal's superior strength, at his hauteur, his low estimation of you. To my own surprise, what I felt in those first moments in my father's presence was precisely the zoo-goer's subtle shame. The surge of emotion took me by surprise. I had not expected to feel much of anything. Let's be honest, Billy Barber was a stranger to me. I had not seen him in 45 years or so since I was a kid, but I could not have been more frozen by him. He held me as surely as if he had somehow materialized on my side of the glass and wrapped me in his arms. He stood there, framed in the window, a three-quarter-length portrait of an old con, his eyes on me. He gave a little snort. I broke eye contact, and he sat down. A guard stood several feet behind him near the blank wall. Everything was blank, every wall, every door, every surface. From what I could see, Northern CI seemed to be made up entirely of unbroken white plaster walls and gray concrete walls. The facility was new, completed only in 1995, so I assumed the lack of color was part of some crazy-making penal strategy. After all, it is no harder to paint a wall yellow or blue than white. My father picked up his phone. Even as I write the words, my father, I feel a little thrill, and my mind reverses the film of my life back to 1961 when I last saw him, in the visiting room at the Whaley Avenue jail. That is the moment of divergence. The whole contingent, ramifying course of our two lives begins there. And I picked up my phone. Thanks for seeing me.
They're not exactly standing in line.
On his wrist was the blue tattoo I had remembered for so many years. It was actually quite small and indistinct, a little fuzzy-edged crucifix that had darkened with age to plum purple, like a deep bruise. I had misremembered it. I had misremembered him. He was only average height, thin, more muscular now than I'd imagined. Ropey jailhouse muscles, even at 72. He had picked up a new tattoo as well, much more intricate and artful than the old one. A dragon that coiled itself around his neck so that its tail and snout met at the base of his throat like a necklace pendant.
About time you come see me.
I sniffed. The risible suggestion that his feelings were hurt, that he was the victim here, pissed me off. What balls. Typical con, this guy was. Always wheedling, angling, gaming.
"What's it been?" he went on. "A whole life? A whole life I'm rotting away and you don't have time to come see your old man. Not even once. What kind of kid are you? What kind of kid does that?"
"You practice that speech? Don't smart mouth me. What'd I ever do to you, huh?
Nothing. But a whole life you never come see me. Your own father. What kind of kid doesn't visit his own father for 40 years?
I'm your son. That should explain it."
"My son? Not my son. I don't know you. Never laid eyes on you."
"Want to see my birth certificate?"
"Like I'd give a shit about a fucking birth certificate. You think that's what makes a son?
One squirt 50 years ago, that's what you are to me.
What'd you think, I'd be happy to see you? Did you think I'd be jumping up and down, whoop-de-fucking-do?"
"You could have said no. I wasn't on your visitor list."
"No one's on my fucking list. What do you think?"
"Who would be on my fucking list? They don't let people visit here anyway, just immediate family."
"You want me to leave?"
"No. Did you hear me say that?"
He shook his head, frowned. "This fucking place, this place is the worst. I haven't been here the whole time, you know. They move me around. You do bad somewhere else, they send you here. It's a hole."
He seemed to lose interest in the subject, and he fell silent. I did not speak. I have found in any Q&A, in court, in witness interviews, wherever, often the best thing you can do is wait, say nothing. The witness will want to fill the awkward silence. He will feel a vague compulsion to keep talking, to prove he is not holding back, to prove he is smart and in the know, to earn your trust. In this case, I think, I waited just out of habit. Certainly I had no intention of leaving, not until he said yes. His mood shifted. He slumped. Almost visibly, he went from petulant to resigned, even self-pitying.
"Well," he said, "you came out big, at least. She must have fed you good."
"She did fine, with everything."
"How is she, your mother?"
"What do you give a shit?"
"I don't."
"So don't talk about her."
"Why shouldn't I?"
I shook my head.
"I knew her before you did," he said.
He squirmed in his chair with a leer, wiggled his hips, mimed fucking her. "Your grandson is in trouble, did you know that?"
"Did I?
I didn't even know I had a grandson. What's his name?"
"Jacob."
"Jacob? What's so funny?
The fuck kind of faggot name is Jacob?"
"It's a name."
Bouncing with laughter, he sang in falsetto, "Jacob!
Watch your mouth. He's a good kid."
"Yeah? Can't be that good or you wouldn't be here."
I said, "Watch your mouth."
"What's little Jacob in trouble for?"
"Murder."
"Murder? Murder? How old is he?"
14. My father lowered the phone to his lap and slumped back in his chair. When he sat back up again, he said,
"Who'd he kill?"
"No one. He's innocent."
"Yeah, so am I."
"He's really innocent."
"Okay, okay."
"You never heard anything about this?"
"I never hear about anything in here. This place is a toilet."
"You must be the oldest con in here."
"One of them."
"I don't know how you survive it."
"You can't hurt steel."
The handcuffs forced him to raise both arms as he held the phone in his left hand, and he flexed his unoccupied right arm.
"You can't hurt steel."
But then his bravado vanished.
"This place is a hole," he said. "It's like living in a fucking cave."
He had a way of swinging between the two poles of hypermachismo and self-pity. It was hard to tell which one was a put-on. Maybe neither was. On the street, this sort of emotional volatility would have seemed crazy. In here, who knew? Maybe it was a natural reaction to this place.
"You put yourself in this place."
"I put myself in this place and I'm doing my bid and I'm not complaining. You hear me complaining?"
I did not answer.
"So what do you want out of me?
You want me to do something for poor, innocent little Jacob?"
"I may want you to testify."
Testify to what?
Let me ask you something.
When you killed that girl, what did it feel like? Not physically. I mean, what was in your mind? What were you thinking about?
What do you mean, what was I thinking about?
Why did you do it?
What do you want me to say? You tell me.
I just want you to tell the truth.
Yeah, right. Nobody wants that. Especially the people who tell you they want the truth. Trust me, they don't want the truth.
You tell me what you want me to say to help the kid out, and I'll say it. I don't give a shit. What do I give a shit?
Let me put it this way. When it happened, were you thinking anything? Anything at all? Or was it kind of an irresistible impulse?
The corner of his mouth curled upward.
An irresistible impulse?
Just answer. Is that what you're going for?
Never mind what I'm going for. I'm not going for anything. Just tell me what you felt.
I felt an irresistible impulse.
I exhaled loud and long.
You know, if you were a better liar, you might not be in here. If you weren't such a good liar, you might not be out there.
He eyed me.
You want me to help get the kid off? I'll help you. He's my grandkid. Just tell me what you need.
I had already decided Bloody Billy Barber was not going to come within 10 miles of the witness stand. He was worse than a liar. He was a bad liar.
All right, I said. You want to know what I came for?
This is what I came for.
I held up a little packet, a sterile swab and a plastic envelope to hold it.
I need to wipe your gums with this, for DNA.
The guards won't let you.
Let me worry about the guards. I need you to let me.
What do you need my DNA for?
We're testing for a certain mutation. It's called MAOA knockout.
What in the fuck is MAOA knockout?
It's a genetic mutation. They think it might code your body to be more aggressive in certain environments.
Who thinks that?
Scientists. His eyes narrowed. You could practically read his thoughts, the selfish opportunism of a career con. Maybe here was an argument to flip his own conviction.
The more you talk, the more I think maybe Jacob isn't so innocent.
I didn't come here to hear your opinion. I came to get your spit on this Q-tip. If you say no, I'll go get a court order and come back and we'll take it the hard way.
Why would I say no?
Why would you do anything? Guys like you, I don't understand.
What's to understand? I'm the same as anyone else. Same as you.
Yeah, okay, whatever.
Don't give me okay, whatever. Did you ever stop to think that without me you wouldn't exist?
Every day.
See? There.
It's not a happy thought.
Well, I'm still your old man, kiddo, whether you like it or not. It don't have to make you happy.
It don't. After some negotiation and a call to the deputy warden, a deal was struck. I would not be allowed to swab my father's mouth personally, which would have been the best method because it would create the cleanest chain of custody. I could testify that the sample was genuine because the Q-tip never left my possession. Not at Northern. No contact meant no contact. At length, I was allowed to give the kit to a guard who passed it to my father. I talked him through the procedure step by step on the phone in the visiting booth. All you have to do is break open the package and wipe the Q-tip around your cheek a little, just so it soaks up a little spit. Swallow first. Then wipe it on the inside of your cheek near the back of your mouth, back where your jaws meet. Then I want you to put the Q-tip in that plastic bottle there without touching the tip to anything else, then screw the top on. Then I want you to put that label across the top and sign and date the label. And I need to be able to watch you do all that, so don't block me. With his hands still cuffed, he ripped open the paper package holding the swab. It was a long wooden stick, longer than an ordinary Q-tip. He put the swab straight into his mouth like a lollipop, and he pretended to bite it. Then, looking at me through the window, he bared his teeth and wiped the cotton tip across his upper front gums. Then he swirled it around at the back of his mouth, in the pocket of his cheek. He held the stick up to the window.
Now you.
Part 3. I have in mind an experiment. Take an infant, regardless of ancestry, race, talent, or predilection, so long as he is essentially healthy, and I will make of him whatever you like.
I will produce an artist, soldier, doctor, lawyer, priest, or I will raise him to be a thief. You may decide. The infant is equally capable of all these things. All that is required is training, time, and a properly controlled environment. John F. Watkins, Principles of Behaviorism, 1913. Chapter 24. It's Different from Others. For years, I never expected to lose in court. In practice, I did lose, of course. Every lawyer loses, just as every baseball player makes an out 70% of the time he goes to bat. But I was never intimidated, and I spat on prosecutors who were, the politicians and wheeler-dealers who were afraid to try a case that was not a sure thing, who would not risk a not guilty. To a prosecutor, there is no dishonor in a not guilty, not when the alternative is a sleazy deal. We are not measured by simple won-lost records. The truth is, the best won-lost records are not built on great trial work. They are built on cherry-picking only the strongest cases for trial and pleading out the rest, regardless of the right and wrong of it. That was LeJudice's way, not mine. Better to fight and lose than sell out your victim. That is one reason I loved homicides. You cannot plead guilty to murder in Massachusetts. Every case must go to trial. The rule is a remnant of the days when murder was punishable by death in this state. In a capital case, no shortcuts were permitted, no deals. The stakes were simply too high. So to this day, every homicide case, no matter how lopsided, must be tried. Prosecutors cannot cherry-pick the sure winners for trial and the long shots to dump. Well, I liked to think, so much the better. Then the difference will be me. I will win even with the weaker case. That was how I saw it. But then, we all tell ourselves stories about ourselves. The money man tells himself that by getting rich he is actually enriching others. The artist tells himself that his creations are things of deathless beauty. The soldier tells himself he is on the side of the angels. Me? I told myself that in court I could make things turn out right. That when I won, justice was served. You can get drunk on such thinking. And in Jacob's case, I was. As the trial approached, I felt a familiar battlefield euphoria. It never crossed my mind that we would lose. I was energized, optimistic, confident, pugnacious. All of it, in hindsight, seems strangely disconnected from reality. But it is not so strange if you think about it. Treat a man like an anvil, and he will long to hit back. The trial began in mid-October 2007, at the height of leaf season. Soon the trees would release their leaves all at once, but for the moment the foliage was in its final brilliant efflorescence of red, orange, and mustard. On the eve of the trial, a Tuesday night, the air was unseasonably warm. The overnight temperature did not fall much below 60 degrees, and the air was dense, humid, agitated. I woke up in the middle of the night, sensing something wrong in the atmosphere, as I always do when Lori cannot sleep. She was lying on her side, up on one elbow, head propped in her hand. "What's wrong?" I whispered to her. "Listen." "To what?" "Shh, just wait. Listen." Outside, the night rustled. There was a loud screech. It began as an animal's yelp, then quickly rose into a piercing, high-pitched shriek, like the screel of a train's brakes. "What on earth is that?" she said. "I don't know. A cat? A bird, maybe? Something is killing it." "What would be killing a cat?" "A fox? A coyote? Raccoon, maybe?" "It's like we live in the woods all of a sudden. This is the city. I've lived here all my life. We never had foxes and coyotes. And those huge wild turkeys we get in the yard, we never had any of that." "There's a lot of new development. The town's getting built up. Their natural habitats are disappearing. They're getting flushed out into the open." "Listen to that sound, Andy. I can't even tell what direction it's coming from or how far away it is. It's like it's right next to us. It must be one of the neighbor's cats." We listened. It came again. This time, the dying animal's screeches definitely sounded like a cat. The cry began recognizably as a cat's mewling,
before the wild, electrified shrieks began.
Why is it taking so long?
Maybe it's toying with its prey. Cats do that with mice, I know.
It's awful.
It's nature.
To be cruel? To torture your prey before you kill it? How is that natural? What evolutionary advantage does cruelty give?
I don't know, Lori. It's just the way it is. Whatever would attack a cat like that, some starving coyote or wild dog or whatever, I'm sure it's desperate. It can't be easy to hunt around here.
If he's desperate, then he should kill it and eat it already.
Why don't we try to get some sleep? We've got a big day tomorrow.
How can I sleep with that?
You want one of my Ambien?
No, they knocked me out all the next morning. I want to be alert tomorrow.
I don't know how you take those things.
Are you kidding? I eat them like Tic Tacs. They don't knock me out enough. I don't need pills, Andy, and I just want that sound to stop.
Come on, lie down. She let her head down. I folded my body against her back, and she seated herself against me.
You're just nervous, Lori. It's understandable. I don't know if I can do this, Andy. Really, I don't have the strength.
We'll get through it.
It's easier for you. You've seen the whole process before, and you're not a mother. Not that this is easy for you, I know it's not, but it's different for me. I just can't do it. I'm not going to make it.
I wish I could make it go away for you, Lori, but I can't.
No. This helps anyway, what you're doing now. We'll just lie here. It has to stop soon.
The shrieks went on for another 15 minutes or so. Neither of us slept much, even after they stopped. When we emerged from our house at 8 o'clock the next morning, a Fox 25 news van idled across the street, smoke wisping from the tailpipe. A cameraman filmed us as we walked to the car. He was faceless behind his shoulder-held camera, or rather, the camera was his face, his one-eyed insect head. Outside the courthouse in Cambridge, we made our way to the front entrance on Thorndike Street, where reporters swarmed. Again, they bumbled against one another as we came up the block. Again, the cameras jostled for a clear shot. Again, the microphones probed the air in front of us. The crush of reporters was much easier to deal with this time, having been through it once before at the arraignment. Jacob's presence excited them most, but I was oddly thankful that Jacob had to run this gauntlet. I had a theory that it was always better for a defendant to be bailed and out on the street than to be held in the pre-trial lockup, as most of my own murder defendants had been. Defendants who did not make bail seemed to leave the building only one way, via the prisoner's exit, heading for Concord, not home. Those prisoner defendants moved down through the courthouse, like meat through a grinder or like the steel balls that bounced down a pachinko machine. From the jail on the top floors, down through the various courtrooms, finally out through the basement-level garage, where the sheriff's vans carted them off to the various prisons. Better that Jacob walk in through the front door. Better that he retain his freedom and dignity as long as possible. Once this building caught you in its gears, it did not like to let go. Chapter 25. The school teacher, glasses girl, the fat Somerville guy, Urkel, the recording studio guy, the housewife, braces woman, and other oracles of truth. In Middlesex County, judges were ostensibly assigned to trials at random. No one actually believed such a lottery existed. The same few judges were assigned high-profile cases over and over, and the judges who kept drawing the winning lottery tickets tended to be prima donnas. Just the sort who would lobby for the gig behind the scenes. But no one ever complained. Bucking the entrenched routines of that courthouse was generally an exercise in pissing up wind. And anyway, the self-selection of egomaniacal judges probably was for the best. It takes a healthy dose of ego to keep command of a contentious courtroom. That, and it made for a better show. Big cases need big personalities. So it came as no surprise that the judge assigned to Jacob's trial was Burton French. Everyone knew he would be. The hair-netted cafeteria ladies, the mental patient janitors, even the mice that scratched around behind the ceiling tiles all knew that if a TV camera was going to be in the courtroom, the judge on the bench would be Burt French. He was very likely the only judge whose face the public recognized, as he appeared often on the local news shows to dilate on matters legal. The camera loved him. In person, he had a slightly laughable Colonel Blimp appearance, a wine-cask body supported uncertainly by two wiry legs. But as a talking head on the TV screen, he projected the sort of reassuring gravity we like to see in our judges. He spoke in definitive declarations, none of the "on the one hand, on the other hand" that journalists rely on. At the same time, he was never bombastic. He never seemed to be faking or provoking, manufacturing the heat that TV loves. Rather, he had a way of using his square, serious face, of tucking in his chin and leveling his eyes at the camera and saying things like, "The law does not permit this or that." You could hardly blame viewers for thinking, "If the law could talk, this is what it would sound like." What made all this so unbearable to the lawyers who gathered to gossip before the first session every morning or over lunch at the Cinnabon in the Galleria food court was that Judge French's gruff no-bullshit attitude was itself pure bullshit. The man who presented himself in public as the embodiment of the law, they thought, was in reality a publicity seeker, an intellectual lightweight, and in the courtroom a petty tyrant, which made him the perfect embodiment of the law when you really thought about it. Of course, by the time Jake's trial began, I did not give a rat's ass about Judge French's failings. All that mattered was the game, and Bert French was an advantage to us. He was essentially conservative, not the sort of judge to go out on a limb for a novel legal theory like the murder gene. Equally important, he was the sort of judge who liked to test the lawyers who appeared before him. He had a bully's instinct for weakness or uncertainty, and he loved to torment bumbling, unprepared lawyers. Throwing Neil LaJudas in front of a guy like that was chumming the water, and Lynn Canavan made a mistake by doing it in such an important case. But then, what choice did she have? She could not send me anymore. So it began. But it began, as is often the case with an event you have anticipated too eagerly for too long, with a sense of anticlimax. We waited in the crowded gallery of courtroom 12B as the clock spun past 9 o'clock, 9:15, 9:30. Jonathan sat beside us, unfazed by the delay. He checked in with the judge's clerk a few times, only to be told each time that there were delays in setting up the pool camera whose video feed the news stations, including court TV, were to share. Then we waited a while longer while the larger-than-usual jury pool which we had reserved was being organized. Jonathan reported these things to us, then opened up his New York Times and read peacefully. At the front of the courtroom, Judge French's clerk, a woman named Mary McQuaid, fiddled with some papers. Then, satisfied, she stood and surveyed the chamber with crossed arms. I always got along with Mary. I made it my business to. The court clerks were gatekeepers to the judges and therefore influential. Mary in particular seemed to enjoy the second-hand prestige of her position, the nearness to power. And the truth is, she did her job well, brokering between Judge French's blustering and the lawyer's constant jockeying for advantage. The word bureaucrat has a negative connotation, but we do need bureaucracies after all, and it is good bureaucrats that make them go. Mary certainly made no apologies for her place in the system. She wore expensive, stylish eyeglasses and decent suits, as if to separate herself from the hacks in the other courtrooms. In a chair along the far wall was the court officer, an enormous fat man named Ernie Zanelli. Ernie was 60-odd years old and 300-odd pounds. And if there was ever actually trouble in the courtroom, the poor guy would probably keel over of a heart attack. His presence as the judge's enforcer was purely symbolic, like the gavel. But I loved Ernie. Over the years, he had grown increasingly open with me about his opinion of defendants, which were generally unfavorable in the extreme, and about judges and lawyers, which were only slightly more positive. That morning, these two old colleagues of mine barely acknowledged me. Mary glanced in my direction occasionally, but gave no sign she had ever seen me before. Ernie risked a little grin. They seemed afraid someone might think that any friendly gestures were directed at Jacob, who sat beside me. I wondered if they had been instructed to ignore me. Probably they just figured I had joined the other team. When the judge finally did take the bench a little before 10, we were stiff from sitting.
Everyone stood at Ernie's recital of the familiar, "Oyez, oyez, oyez, the Superior Court of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts is now in session." And Jacob fidgeted right through to the end. "All ye having business before this court, come forward and ye shall be heard." His mother and I both put a hand on Jacob's back to reassure him. The case was called, Jonathan gestured to Jacob, and the two of them crossed the bar and took their seats at the defense table, as they would every morning for the next 2 weeks. This would be Lori's view of the entire trial. From the front row of the gallery benches, she would sit impassively for hour after hour, day after day, staring at the back of Jacob's head. Poised on that bench, my wife looked very pale and thin among the spectators, as if Jacob's case was a cancer that she had to endure, a physical struggle. And yet, no matter how she withered, I could not help seeing in Lori the ghost of her younger self, the teenaged girl with a lovely, full, heart-shaped face. I have an idea that this is what enduring love really means. Your memories of a girl at 17 become as real and vivid as the middle-aged woman sitting in front of you. It is a happy sort of double vision, this seeing and remembering. To be seen this way is to be known. Lori was miserable sitting there. The parents of young defendants have been consigned to a peculiar purgatory in these trials. We were expected to be present, but silent. We were implicated in Jacob's crime as both victims and perpetrators. We were pitied, since we had done nothing wrong. We had just been unlucky, lost the pregnancy lottery, and been stuck with a rogue child. Sperm plus egg equals murderer, something like that. Can't be helped. At the same time, we were despised. Somebody had to be responsible for Jacob, and we had created the boy and raised him. We must have done something wrong. Even worse, now we had the gall to support the killer. We actually wanted to see him get away with it, which only confirmed our antisocial nature, our bone-deep badness. Of course, the public view of us was so contradictory and jumped up with emotion that there was no way to answer it, no right way to act. People would think what they wanted. They would imagine for us whatever sinister or suffering interior life they chose. And for the next 2 weeks, Lori would play her part. She would sit there at the back of the courtroom as still and expressionless as a marble statue. She would watch the back of her son's head, trying to interpret the tiniest micro-movements. She would react to nothing. It did not matter that once she had held that baby boy in her arms and whispered in his ear, "Shh, shh." At this point, nobody gave a shit. When he finally took the bench, Judge French scanned the room as the clerk read out the case. Number 08-4407, Commonwealth versus Jacob Michael Barber, a single count of murder in the first degree. For the defendant, Jonathan Klein. For the Commonwealth, Assistant District Attorney Neil LaJudas. The judge's handsome, grave face settled briefly on each of the players, Jacob, the lawyers, even us, conferring on each a momentary significance while we were in his gaze, which vanished as soon as his eyes swept on. Over the years, I had tried many cases before Judge French, and although I thought he was a bit of an empty suit, I liked him well enough. He had been a football player at Harvard, a defensive lineman. In his senior year, he had fallen on a fumble in the end zone against Yale, and this singular, brilliant moment had stuck with him. He kept a framed picture of it on his office wall, big Bert French in his crimson and gold uniform, lying on his side on the ground, cuddling the precious egg he'd found. I suspect the picture struck me differently than it did Judge French. To me, he was the sort of guy such things happened to. Rich and good-looking and all the rest, no doubt opportunities had always presented themselves like so many footballs lying in his way, and he had merely to fall on them, all the while presuming his good fortune was the natural product of his talent. One wonders how a charmed man like him would have been affected by a father like Bloody Billy Barber. All that ease, all that naturalness, all that credulous self-confidence. For years I had studied men like Bert French, despised them, copied them. "Mr. Klein," the judge said, slipping on a pair of half-glasses, "any preliminary motions before we begin the voir dire?" Jonathan stood. "A couple of things, Your Honor. First, the defendant's father, Andrew Barber, would like to enter an appearance in the case on the defendant's behalf. With the court's permission, he is going to second chair me at the trial." Jonathan went to the clerk and handed her the motion,
a single sheet announcing that I would be part of the defense team. The clerk handed the sheet to the judge, who frowned at it.
"It's not really my decision, Mr. Klein, but I'm not sure it's wise, either."
"It's the family's wish," Jonathan said, distancing himself from the decision. The judge scribbled his name on the sheet, allowing the motion.
"Mr. Barber, you can come forward."
I came around the bar and sat down at the defense table beside Jacob.
"Anything else?"
"Your Honor, I have filed a motion in limine to exclude scientific evidence based on an alleged genetic predisposition to violence."
"Yes, I have read your motion, and I am inclined to allow it. Do you wish to be heard further before I rule?"
"As I understand it, your position is that the science has not been established, and even if it was, there is no specific evidence of a violent propensity, genetic or otherwise, in this case. Is that the gist of it?"
"Yes, Your Honor, that's the gist."
"Mr. LeJudas, do you want to be heard or will you rest on your brief? It seems to me the defense is entitled to a hearing on that sort of evidence before it comes in."
"Mind you, I'm not excluding such evidence definitively. I am merely ruling that if you choose to offer evidence of a genetic tendency to violence, we will hold a hearing at that time outside the jury's presence to decide whether it will be admitted or not."
"Yes, Your Honor, I would like to be heard on that."
The judge blinked at him. His face read plain as day. "Sit down and shut up."
LeJudas stood and buttoned his suit coat, a slim 3-button number that, when buttoned up this way, did not fit him properly. LeJudas's neck craned forward slightly while the jacket stayed erect, which caused the coat collar to float an inch or two away from his neck like a monk's cowl.
"Your Honor, the Commonwealth's position, and we are prepared to offer expert evidence on this point, is that the science of behavioral genetics has made great strides and continues to advance every day, and it is already mature enough by far and away to be admitted here. We would submit that this is even the extreme case where to exclude such evidence would be improper."
"The motion is allowed."
LeJudas stood there a moment, unsure if his pocket had just been picked.
"Mr. LeJudas," the judge explained as he signed the motion, "allowed, French, J., I have not excluded the evidence. My ruling is simply that if you want to offer it, you will have to provide notice to the defense and we will have a hearing on its admissibility before you offer it to the jury. Understood?"
"Understood, Your Honor."
"Let me be crystal clear. Not a word of it until I rule it's coming in."
"Understood, Your Honor."
"We're not going to turn this into a circus."
The judge sighed.
"All right. Anything else before I bring in the jury, Veneri?"
The lawyers shook their heads. With a series of nods, the judge to the clerk to the court officer, the potential jurors were fetched from one of the lower floors. They shuffled in, rubbernecking the courtroom like tourists wandering through Versailles. The chamber must have disappointed them. It was a grungy courtroom in the modern style. High boxy ceilings, minimalist furnishings of maple wood and black laminate, muted indirect lighting. 2 flags drooped from listing flagpoles, an American flag to the judge's right and the flag of Massachusetts to his left. The American flag at least had its original vivid colors. The state flag, once pure white, had faded to a dingy ivory. Otherwise, there was nothing, no statue, no chiseled Latin inscription, no portrait of a forgotten judge. Nothing to relieve the Scandinavian austerity of the design. I had been in this courtroom 1,000 times, but the juror's disappointment made me look at it finally and realize how exhausted it all appeared. The jury pool filled the entire gallery at the back of the courtroom, leaving only the 2 benches that had been reserved for the defendant's family, reporters, and a few others whose courthouse connections entitled them to remain. The potential jurors were a mix of working people and housewives, kids and retirees. Jury pools usually skewed slightly blue-collar and underemployed, since these were the people more likely to respond to a summons. But this jury pool had a vaguely professional look to it, I thought. Lots of good haircuts, new shoes, BlackBerry holsters, pens sticking out of pockets. This, too, was good for us, I decided. We wanted smart, cool-headed jurors, people with the brains to understand a technical defense or the limitations of scientific evidence, and the balls to say not guilty.
We began the process of voir dire, the question-and-answer process by which juries are chosen. Jonathan and I each had our jury seating charts, a table of 2 rows, 6 columns, 12 places in all, plus 2 extra boxes on the right side of the sheet, matching the chairs in the jury box. 12 jurors, plus 2 alternates who would hear all the evidence but would not take part in the deliberations, unless one of the jurors dropped out. 14 candidates were called forward, 14 chairs were filled, we scribbled the names plus a few notes in the boxes on our scorecards, and the process began. Jonathan and I conferred on each potential juror. We had 6 peremptory challenges, which we could use to eliminate a juror without stating a reason, and an unlimited number of challenges for cause, meaning challenges based on some explicit reason to think the juror would be biased. For all the strategizing, jury selection has always been something of a shot in the dark. There are pricey experts who claim to remove some of the guesswork using focus groups, psychological profiling, statistics, and so on, the scientific method. But predicting how a stranger will judge your case, especially based on the very limited information in a jury questionnaire, is frankly more art than science, the more so in Massachusetts, where the rules severely limit how extensively jurors may be questioned. And yet, we tried to sort them. We looked for education, for suburbanites who might sympathize with Jacob and not hold his comfortable background against him, for dispassionate professions like accountant, engineer, programmer. Lejudas tried to load up on working folks, parents, anyone who might be outraged at the crime and who would have little problem believing a boy could kill even on scant provocation. Jurors came forward, sat, were dismissed, and new candidates came forward and sat, and we scribbled details about them in our seating charts. And 2 hours later, we had our jury. We gave each juror a nickname so we could remember them. They were the school teacher, forewoman, glasses girl, grandpa, fat Somerville guy, recording studio guy, Urkel, the canal, a woman born in Panama, Waltham mom, the waitress, construction guy, properly a wood floor installer, a surly, squinty-eyed piece of work whom we worried about from the start, Concord housewife, truck driver, actually a delivery guy for a commercial food supply company, braces woman, alternate, and the bartender, alternate. They had nothing in common except their glaring lack of qualifications for the job. It was almost comical how ignorant they were of the law, of how trials worked, even of this case, which had been splashed all over the newspapers and evening news. They were chosen for their perfect ignorance of these things. That is how the system works. In the end, the lawyers and judges happily step aside and hand the entire process over to a dozen complete amateurs. It would be funny if it were not so perverse. How futile the whole project is. Surely Jacob must have realized it as he looked at those 14 blank faces. The towering lie of the criminal justice system, that we can reliably determine the truth, that we can know beyond a reasonable doubt who is guilty and who is not, is built on this whopper of an admission. After 1,000 years or so of refining the process, judges and lawyers are no more able to say what is true than a dozen knuckleheads selected at random off the street. Jacob must have shivered at the thought. Chapter 26. Someone is watching. That night, after dinner, in the safety of our kitchen, we chattered excitedly. Words came tumbling, grumbles, boasts, fears. We were working off nervous energy more than anything else. Lori did her best to keep all the talk going. She was evidently exhausted from a sleepless night and a long day, but she always believed that the more we talked, the better off we would all be. So she posed questions and confessed her own fears and kept passing dishes of food, inviting us to talk and talk. In these light moments, I glimpsed the old, effervescent Lori. Or rather, I heard her, for her voice never aged. In every other way, Lori withered during Jacob's crisis. Her eyes looked sunken and haunted. Her peaches and cream complexion became sallow and cracked. But her voice was gloriously untouched. When she opened her mouth, out came the same teenage girl's voice I had first heard nearly 35 years before. It was like a phone call from 1974. At one point, Jacob said of the jury,
I don't think they liked me, just the way they were looking at me.
Jacob, they've only been in the box one day. Give them a chance. Besides, so far all they know about you is that you've been accused of murder. What do you expect them to think?
They're not supposed to think anything yet.
They're human, Jake. Just don't give them any reason to dislike you. That's all you can do. Stay cool. No reactions. None of your faces.
What faces?
You have a face you make when you're not paying attention. You scowl.
I don't scowl.
You do.
Mom, do I scowl?
I haven't noticed it. Sometimes your father gets carried away with the strategy.
You do, Jake. It's like, I made the scowling face.
Dad, that's not a scowl. You just look constipated.
Hey, I'm serious. That's what you look like when you're not paying attention. It makes you look angry. Don't let the jury see that face.
That's my face. What can I do?
Just be your handsome self, Jacob,
Lori said sweetly. She gave him a broken little smile. Her sweatshirt was on backwards. She seemed unaware of it, though the tag rubbed against her throat.
Hey, speaking of my handsome self, did you guys know there's a Twitter hashtag about me?
Lori,
what does that mean?
It's a way for people to talk about me on Twitter.
And what they're saying?
It's all like, Jacob Barber is gorgeous. I want to have his baby. Jacob Barber is innocent.
Me.
Yeah, what else are they saying?
All right, there's some bad things, but mostly it's positive, like 70%.
70% positive?
About.
You've been following it that closely?
It only happened today, but yeah, of course I read it.
You've got to check it out, Dad. Just go to Twitter and search for #, Jacob Barber, no spaces.
He wrote it on his paper napkin.
I was a trending topic.
Do you know what that means?
Usually that's like Kobe Bryant or Justin Timberlake or people like that.
That's great, Jacob.
I gave a skeptical look to the boy's mother.
This was not the first time our son's internet celebrity had come up. Someone, probably a school friend, had put together a website, jacobbarber.com, to support him. The site featured a message board where people could declare Jacob's innocence or wish him well or expound on his saintly character. Negative messages were filtered out. There was a Facebook group supporting him, too. The consensus online was that Jacob was a little odd, possibly homicidal, definitely attractive, conclusions that were not unrelated. He also got occasional text messages on his cell phone from strangers. Most were vicious, but not all. Some were from girls who told him he was cute or made sexual propositions. He claimed these messages ran about 2-to-1 negative versus positive, and this seemed to be enough for him. He knew he was innocent, after all. Anyway, he did not want to change his cell phone number.
Lori,
maybe you should stay off Facebook and all that, Jacob, at least until this is over.
I just read, Mom. I never write anything. I'm a lurker.
A lurker? Oh, don't use that word. Do me a favor. Just stay away from the internet for a while, will you? You could get hurt.
Jacob, I think what your mother is saying is that the next couple of weeks may go easier if we just try to stay on an even keel. So maybe we should all just close our ears a little bit.
I'll miss my 15 minutes of fame, he said.
He grinned, oblivious and blithely brave as only a kid can be. Lori looked horrified.
That'd be a real shame, I grumbled.
Jacob, let's hope you have your 15 minutes of fame for something else.
We all went quiet. Silverware clinked on plates.
Lori said, I wish that guy would turn off his engine.
What guy?
That guy.
She gestured with her knife toward the window.
Don't you hear him? There's a guy sitting in his car out there with the engine running. It's giving me a headache. It's like this buzz in my ear that won't go away. What's the word for that when you get a buzz in your ear?
Tinnitus, I said. She made a face.
Crossword puzzles, I explained.
I got up to look out the window, more curious than concerned. It was a big sedan. I couldn't make out precisely what model. Some oversized end of the American auto industry crap four-door. Maybe a Lincoln. It was parked across the street, two houses down, in a dark area between streetlights where I could not see the driver at all, even in silhouette.
Inside, there was a dot of amber light like a star as the driver took a drag from a cigarette. Then the little star winked out.
Probably just waiting for someone.
So let him wait with his engine off. Hasn't this guy heard of global warming?
Probably an older guy. I was inferring from the cigarette, the idling engine, the aircraft carrier-sized car, all habits that belonged to an older generation, I thought.
Asshole's probably a reporter, Jacob said.
Jake?
Sorry, Mom.
Lori, why don't I go talk to him? I'll tell him to turn it off.
No. Who knows what he wants? Whatever he's up to, it can't be good. Just stay put.
Honey, you're being paranoid. I never used words like honey or sweetie or dear, but the gentle tone seemed necessary.
It's probably just some old geezer smoking a butt listening to the radio. He probably doesn't realize he's bothering anyone leaving the engine running.
She frowned skeptically.
You're the one who keeps saying we have to keep our heads down, stay out of trouble. Maybe he wants you to come out there and try something. Maybe he's trying to bait you into it.
Lori, come on, it's just a car.
Just a car, huh?
Just a car. But it was not just a car. Around 9, I took out the garbage. One plastic barrel of trash, one awkward rectangular green bucket of recycling. The recycling bucket was sized in such a way that it could not quite be carried in one hand comfortably. Your fingers always began to cramp halfway up the driveway, so that carrying both items to the sidewalk in one trip involved a fast, waddling race walk out to the street before the recycling spilled all over. It was not until I had put the barrel and the recycling bucket down and arranged them neatly side by side that I noticed the same car again. It had moved. This time it was parked a few houses away from ours in the other direction, again across the street. The engine was off. No firefly of a burning cigarette inside. The car might even have been empty. It was impossible to tell in the dark. I peered into the dark to make out some details about the car. The engine came on, then the headlights. The car had no front license plate. I began to pace toward it, curious. The car backed away from me slowly, like an animal sensing a threat. Then it backed away fast. At the first cross street, it did a quick, expert turnaround and drove off. I never got closer than 20 yards. In the dark, I could not make out anything about the car, not even the color or the make. It was reckless driving on such a small street. Reckless and good. Later still, after Lori had sensibly gone to sleep, I sat watching John Stewart with Jacob in the living room. I had spread myself across the couch with my right foot propped on the cushion and my right arm dangling over the backrest. I felt an itch, a faint sensation of being watched, and I lifted the blind to peek out again. The car was back. I went out the back door, through the neighbor's backyard, and emerged behind the car. It was a Lincoln Town Car, license plate 75KSA2. The interior was dark. I walked up slowly alongside the driver's door. I felt ready to knock on the glass, to open the door, pull the guy out of the car, to pin him down on the sidewalk and warn him to stay away from us. But the car was empty. I looked around briefly for the driver, a man with a cigarette. But I was being a fool. Lori was making me paranoid, too. It was just a parked car. Probably the driver was in one of the adjacent houses sound asleep, or screwing his wife, or watching the tube, or doing any of the things normal people do, the things we used to do. What had I really seen, after all? Still, better safe than sorry. I called Paul Duffy. "Counselor," he answered in his old laconic way, as if he was pleased to hear from me. Pleased and not surprised, even after months of silence at 11:30 on the eve of opening statements. "Duff, sorry to bother you."
"No bother. What's wrong?"
"It's probably nothing. I think there might be someone watching us. He's been parked outside all night."
"It's a man?"
"I'm not sure. I didn't see him, just the car."
"You said him."
"I'm assuming."
"What was he doing?"
"It was just a car parked out front of the house with his engine running. This was around 6, dinner time. Then I saw him again around 9 o'clock, but as soon as I started to walk toward him, he turned around and took off."
"Has he threatened you in any way?"
"No."
"Have you ever seen the car before?"
"No, I don't think so."
deep breath into the phone.
Andy, can I give you a piece of advice?
I wish somebody would.
Go to bed. Tomorrow's a big day for you. You're all under a lot of pressure.
You think it's just a parked car?
Sounds to me like it's just a parked car.
Would you do me a favor and run the plate, just to be sure? Lori's really stressed. It'd make her feel better.
Just between you and me?
Of course, Duff.
Okay, give it to me.
It's mass plate number 75KSA2. It's a Lincoln Town car.
All right, hold on.
There was a long silence as he called it in. I watched Stephen Colbert with the sound muted. When he came back, he said,
"That plate belongs to a Honda Accord."
Shit, it's stolen.
No, it hasn't been reported stolen, at least.
So what's it doing on a Lincoln?
Probably just borrowed it in case somebody noticed him and reported the plate to the cops. All you need is a screwdriver.
Shit.
Andy, you need to call this in to Newton PD. It's still probably nothing, but file a report and at least get it on the record.
I don't want to do that right now. The trial starts tomorrow.
If I report it, it'll find its way into the news. I can't have that.
It's important we seem normal and stable right now. I want that jury to see a regular family, just like them, because we are just like them.
Andy, if someone's threatening you...
No, no one's threatened us. No one's actually done anything.
You said yourself it looks just like a parked car.
But you were worried enough that you called me.
Doesn't matter. I'll deal with it. If the jury hears about it, half of them would think we're full of shit.
They think we're faking it to drum up sympathy, like we're trying to play the victim in all this.
No drama. Anything that makes us look odd, untrustworthy, phony, strange, makes it harder to get them to say not guilty.
So what do you want to do?
Maybe you could send a cruiser by without filing a report. Just move him along, scare him off, just so I can tell Lori she doesn't have to worry.
I better do it myself, otherwise there'll have to be a report.
I appreciate it. There's no way I can ever pay you back.
Just get your kid home safe, Andy.
You mean that?
A pause.
I don't know. This whole thing just doesn't feel right. Maybe it's just seeing you and Jacob at the defense table. I've known that kid since he was born.
Paul, he didn't do it, I guarantee it.
He grunted, unconvinced.
Andy, who would be watching your house?
The victim's family? Maybe some kid who knew Ben Rifkin? Some nut who read about the case in the paper? Could be anyone.
Did you guys ever follow up on Pat's?
Who knows? Andy, I have no idea what's going on over there. They've got me in a friggin' public relations unit. Next thing, they'll have me riding up and down the turnpike giving speeding tickets. They pulled me off the case as soon as Jacob got indicted. I half expected them to investigate me like I was in some kind of cover-up with you. So I don't have much information. But there was no reason for them to keep going after Pat's once they charged someone else. The case was already solved.
We both considered that in silence a moment.
All right, he said, I'll be by. Tell Lori it's okay.
I already told her it's okay. She doesn't believe me.
She won't believe me either. Whatever.
You go get some sleep, too.
You two won't make it like this. It's only the first night.
I thanked him and went upstairs to climb in bed with Lori.
She lay curled up like a cat, her back to me.
Who was that? She murmured into her pillow.
Paul.
What did he say?
He said it's probably just a parked car. Everything's okay.
She groaned.
He said you wouldn't believe him.
He was right.
Chapter 27. Openings. What was Neil LaJudas thinking when he stood up to deliver his opening statement to the jury? He was keenly aware of the two unmanned cameras on him. That much was clear as he meticulously buttoned the top two buttons of his coat. It was apparently a second new suit, not the same one he had worn the day before, though today's suit was the same hip three-button style. The shopping spree was a mistake. He tended to preen in his new costumes. He must have imagined himself as a hero. Ambitious, sure, but his goals matched the public's. What was good for Neil was good for everyone, except Jacob, of course. So no harm in that. There must have been a rightness, too, in seeing me at the defense table, literally displaced. I don't mean to suggest there was any sense of Oedipal payback in LeJudas's head that day. Anyway, he gave no outward sign of it. As he arranged his new coat and stood for a moment plumping for the jury, the two juries, I should say, one in court, one on the other side of the TV cameras, I saw only a young man's vanity. I could not hate him or even begrudge him a little self-satisfaction. He had graduated, grown up. He was finally the man. We all have felt such things at one time or another. Oedipal or not, it is a pleasure after long years to stand in our father's place, and it is a perfectly innocent pleasure. Anyway, why blame Oedipus? He was a victim. Poor Oedipus never meant to hurt anybody. LeJudas nodded toward the judge. Show the jury you are respectful. He glared balefully at Jacob as he passed. And that you are not afraid of the defendant, because if you do not have the courage to look him in the eye and say guilty, how can you expect the jury to do it? He stood directly in front of the jury with his fingertips resting on the front rail of the jury box. Close up the space between you. Make them feel you are one of them. A teenage boy, he said, found dead, in a forest called Cold Spring Park, early on a spring morning. A 14-year-old boy stabbed 3 times in a line across the chest and tossed down an embankment slick with mud and wet leaves and left to die face down less than a quarter mile from the school he'd been walking to, a quarter mile from the home he'd left only minutes before. His eyes roamed across the jury box. And the whole thing, the decision to do this, the choice, to take a life, to take this boy's life, it only takes a second. He let the phrase hang there. One split second and, he snapped his fingers, snap. It only takes a second to lose your temper. And that is all you need, a second, an instant, to form the intention to murder. In this courtroom it is called malice aforethought. The conscious decision to kill, however quickly the intention forms, however briefly it is in the murderer's mind. First-degree murder can happen just like that. He began to pace the length of the jury box, lingering to make eye contact with each juror as he passed. Let's think about the defendant a moment. This is a case about a boy who had everything. Good family, good grades, beautiful home in a wealthy suburb. He had it all, more than most anyway, much more. But the defendant had something else, too. He had a lethal temper. And when he was pushed, not too hard, just teased, just messed around with, the sort of thing that must go on every day in every school in the country. But when he was pushed a little too far and he decided he'd had enough, that lethal temper finally just snapped. You must tell the jury the story of the case, the tale that led to the final act. Facts are not enough. You must weave them into a story. The jury must be able to answer the question, what is this case about? Answer that question for them and you win. Distill the case down to a single phrase for them, a theme, even a single word. Embed that phrase in their minds. Let them take it back into the jury room with them, so that when they open their mouths to discuss the case, your words come tumbling out. The defendant snapped. He snapped his fingers again. He came to the defense table, stood too close, purposely disrespecting us by invading our space. He leveled his finger at Jacob, who looked down at his lap to avoid it. LeJudas was entirely full of shit, but his technique was magnificent. But this wasn't just any boy from a good home in a good suburb. And he wasn't just any boy with a quick temper. This defendant had something else that set him apart. LeJudas's finger slid from Jacob to me. He had a father who was an assistant district attorney, and not just any assistant district attorney either. No, the defendant's father, Andrew Barber, was the first assistant, the top man in the very office where I work, right here in this building. In that moment, I could have reached out and grabbed that fucking finger and torn it off LeJudas's pale, freckled hand. I looked him in the eye, showed nothing. This defendant, he withdrew his finger, raised it above his shoulder as if he were testing the wind, Then he wagged it in the air as he moved back to the jury box. "This defendant..." "Do not refer to the defendant by name. Call him only the defendant. A name humanizes him, makes the jury see him as a person worthy of sympathy, even mercy. This defendant wasn't some clueless kid. No, no. He'd watched for years as his father prosecuted every major murder in this county. He'd listened to the dinner table conversations, overheard the phone calls, the shop talk. He grew up in a home where murder was the family business." Jonathan dropped his pen on his notepad, emitted an exasperated hissing sound, and shook his head. The suggestion that murder was the family business came awfully close to the argument LeJudas had been barred from making, but Jonathan did not object. He could not appear to be obstructing the prosecution with technical legalistic defenses. His defense would not be technical. Jacob did not do it. Jonathan did not want to muddy that message. "I understood all this. Still, it was infuriating to watch such contemptible bullshit go unchallenged." The judge eyed LeJudas. "LeJudas, at least murder trials were the family business. The business of proving a murderer guilty. What we're doing right here, right now. This was something the defendant knew a little about, and not from watching TV shows. So when he snapped, when the moment came, the last deadly provocation, and he went after one of his own classmates with a hunting knife, he had already laid the groundwork, just in case. And when it was over, he covered his tracks like an expert. Because, in a way, he was an expert. There was only one problem. Even experts make mistakes. And over the next few days, we're going to uncover the tracks that led right back to him. And only to him. And when you've seen all the evidence, you'll know beyond a reasonable doubt, beyond any doubt, that this defendant is guilty." A pause. "But why?" You're asking. "Why would he kill a boy in his eighth grade class? Why would any child do this to another child?" He made a perplexed gesture, eyebrows raised, big shrug. "Well, we've all been in school." His lips began to curl up into a smirk, conspiratorial. "Let's be naughty together and have a laugh in the courtroom. Come on, we've all been there, some of us more recently than others." He gave a crocodile smile, which was, to my amazement, returned with little knowing grins from the jurors. "That's right, we've all been there, and we all know how kids can be. Let's face it, school can be difficult. Kids can be mean. They tease, they horse around, they poke fun. You're going to hear testimony that the victim in this case, a 14-year-old boy named Ben Rifkin, teased the defendant. Nothing especially shocking. Nothing that would be a big deal to most kids. Nothing you wouldn't hear on any playground in any town if you left this courtroom right now and drove around a bit. Let me be clear about something. It is not necessary to make a saint out of Ben Rifkin, the victim in this case. You're going to hear some things about Ben Rifkin that maybe aren't too flattering. But I want you to remember this. Ben Rifkin was a boy like any other boy. He was not perfect. He was a regular kid with all the flaws and all the growing pains of an ordinary teenager. He was 14 years old, 14, with his whole life stretched out in front of him. Not a saint, not a saint, but who among us would want to be judged only by the first 14 years of our lives? Who among us was complete and finished at 14? Ben Rifkin was everything the defendant wanted to be. He was handsome, cool, popular. The defendant, on the other hand, was an outsider among his own classmates. Quiet, lonely, sensitive, odd. An outcast. But Ben made a fatal mistake in teasing this strange boy. He didn't know about that temper, about the defendant's hidden capacity, even desire, to kill. Objection. Sustained. The jury will disregard the remark about the defendant's desire, which is complete speculation. LeJudas did not look away from the jury. He stood stone still, shirked the objection, pretended he had not even heard it. The judge and the defense are trying to keep it from you, but we know the truth. The defendant made his plans. He got a knife, and not a kid's knife, not a whittling knife, not a Swiss Army knife. A hunting knife, a knife designed for killing.
You will hear about that knife from the defendant's own best friend who saw it in the defendant's hand, who heard the defendant say he meant to use it against Ben Rifkin. You will hear that the defendant thought it all out. He planned the murder. He even described the murder several weeks later in a story that he wrote and even brazenly posted on the internet, a story in which he describes how the murder was conceived, planned in detail, and executed. Now, the defendant may try to explain away this story, which includes a detailed description of Ben Rifkin's murder, including details known only to the actual murderer. He may tell you I was only fantasizing, to which I say, as no doubt you will, what sort of kid fantasizes about a friend's murder? He paced, allowing the question to hang. Here is what we know. When the defendant left his house and set off for Cold Spring Park the morning of April 12, 2007, as he walked off into the woods, he took with him a knife in his pocket and an idea in his head. He was ready. From that point, all that remained was the trigger, the spark that made the defendant snap. So, what was that trigger? What was it that converted a fantasy of murder into the real thing? He paused. It was the central question to be answered, the riddle LeJudas simply had to solve. How does a normal boy with no history of violence suddenly do something so brutal? Motive is an element of every case, not legally, but in the head of each and every juror. That is why motiveless or under-motivated crimes are so hard to prove. Jurors want to understand what happened. They want to know why. They demand a logical answer. Apparently, LeJudas had none. He could only offer theories, guesses, probabilities, murder genes. "We may never know," he admitted, doing his best to shrug off the gaping hole in his case, the very strangeness of the crime, its apparent inexplicability. Did Ben call him a name? Did he call him faggot or pussy as he had in the past? Or geek or loser? Did he push him, threaten him, bully him somehow? Probably. I shook my head. Probably. Whatever it was that set the defendant off, when he met Ben Rifkin in Cold Spring Park that fateful morning, April 12, 2007, around 8:20 a.m., where he knew Ben would be because the two of them had been walking to school through those woods for years, he chose to put his plan into action. He stabbed Ben three times. He punched the knife into his chest. He demonstrated with three sword fighter thrusts of his right arm. 1, 2, 3. 3 neat, evenly spaced wounds in a line across the chest. Even the pattern of the wounds suggests premeditation, coolness, self-control. LeJudas paused, a little uncertainly this time. The jurors appeared unsure also. They watched him with expressions of concern. His opening statement, which had started so strong, had foundered on this all-important question of why. He seemed to want it both ways. At one moment, LeJudas was suggesting Jacob had snapped, lost his temper, and murdered his classmate in a sudden rage. A moment later, he was suggesting Jacob had planned the murder for weeks, deliberated coolly over the details, used the lawyerly expertise of a prosecutor's son, then waited for his opportunity. The trouble, obviously, was that LeJudas himself had never quite been able to answer the question of motive, no matter how many theories he threw at it. The murder of Ben Rifkin just did not make sense. Even now, after months of investigation, we were asking why. I was sure the jury would sense LeJudas's problem. When it was done, the defendant disposed of the knife, and he went off to school. He pretended to know nothing, even when the school was put in a lockdown and the police were frantically trying to solve the case. He kept his cool. Ah, but the defendant ought to have known, this son of a prosecutor from his own long apprenticeship, that murder always leaves a trace. There is no such thing as an immaculate murder. Murder is messy, bloody, filthy work. Blood sprays and spatters. In the excitement of killing, mistakes are made. The defendant had left a fingerprint on the victim's sweatshirt, pressed into the victim's own wet blood, a print that could only have been made in the immediate aftermath of the murder. And then the lies begin to pile up. When the fingerprint is finally identified weeks after the murder, the defendant switches his story. After denying for weeks that he knew anything about the murder, now he claims he was there, but only after the murder.
a skeptical look.
A motive? An outcast schoolboy with a grudge against a classmate who had been teasing him. A weapon, the knife. A plan, detailed in a description of the murder written by the defendant himself. The physical evidence, the fingerprint on the victim's body, in the victim's own blood.
Ladies and gentlemen, the evidence is overwhelming. This is a mountain of evidence. It leaves no room for doubt. When this trial is over and I have proved all the things I have just described to you, I am going to stand right here before you again, this time to ask you to do your part, to say what is obviously true, to draw the only conclusion you can, guilty. That word, guilty, will be hard to say, I promise you. It is hard for anyone to judge another. All our lives we are taught not to. Judge not, the Bible tells us. It is especially hard when the defendant is a child. We believe fervently in the innocence of our children. We want to believe in it. We want our children to be innocent. But this child is not innocent, no. When you look at all the evidence against him, you will know in your heart of hearts there is only one just verdict in this case, guilty. Verdict, from the Latin for say the truth. That is all I am going to ask you to do. Say the truth. Guilty. 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 He gave them a look that was determined, righteous, imploring. Guilty, he said again. He bowed his head mournfully, then returned to his chair where he slumped down, apparently drained or lost in thought, or grieving the dead boy, Ben Rifkin. Behind me, a woman in the audience whimpered. There were sounds of footsteps and the swinging door as she rushed out of the courtroom. I did not dare turn around to look. My sense was that LeJudas's opening had been quite good. It was by far the best I had ever seen him deliver, but it was not the home run he needed. There was still room for doubt. Why did he do it? The jurors must have sensed the weakness in his case, the donut hole at its center. That was a real problem for the prosecution, since there is no time in a trial when the state's case looks stronger than in the opening statement, where the story is pristine and uncontradicted, before the evidence has been dinged up by the realities of a trial, bumbling friendly witnesses, expert hostile witnesses, cross-examination, and all the rest. My impression was that he had left us an opportunity. Defense, the judge said. Jonathan stood up. It struck me at the time, and still does now when I see him, that he was one of those men whom it is easy to imagine as a boy, even in his gray-haired 60s. His hair was perpetually mussed, his coat unbuttoned, his tie and collar always a little askew, as if the whole get-up were a boy's school uniform that he wore only because the rules required it. He stood before the jury box and scratched the back of his head, and his face